Today's program is brought to you by the Museum of Food and Drink, sparking curiosity about food with exhibits you can eat. For more information, visit mofad.org.
Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. We are a member-supported, nonprofit food radio station. That means that every single thing we do, from broadcasting 35 weekly shows for free, to bringing you exclusive content from sold-out food events across the country, to offering scholarships to high school students, is only possible thanks to the support of our loyal members. And we want you to join the club. Become a member during our 2017 summer drive to get access to sweet swag and pledge your support to the world's only food radio station. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate to become a member now.
You're listening to Feast Meets West, the show where we tell the story behind your favorite Asian dishes. Instead of calling in from Hong Kong, this is Iris Van Kerkhove in the studio in person today. And sitting next to me is my lovely co-host, Linda Liu.
Hello.
We are broadcasting from Heritage Radio Network at Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Every episode, Linda and I dig deep on a dish or an aspect of Asian cuisine and talk to experts on the topic to learn more.
But before we get into today's show, Iris and I like to kick off the episode with a question for each other. And that is, what's the best thing you ate in the past week?
Well, it's going to be a tough one for me this week because I just went to Toronto, which I've come to realize is an amazing food city. Mm-hmm. I had so much good food. But I think my best dining out experience was at Bar Isabel, Spanish tapas place. Mm-hmm. Everything there was amazing, but I think the thing I have to mention is the dessert, which is weird because dessert, it's not my favorite, but they have this thing called the Basque cake, mm-hmm. and there was just so much hype around it. Like, we were looking up Yelp reviews, and everyone was like, the cake is life-changing. You have to get it.
Okay.
And then the people sitting next to us were like, I can't wait for the Basque cake. And then when we got it, they were like, oh, my God, you got the Basque cake. I'm so excited for you. And I have to say, it was really good. It was so simple, but just well-executed, and that's my favorite kind of dessert.
Is it, like, Instagrammable, or is it just, like, taste-wise?
No, not really. Yeah, just taste-wise, it's just great.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
How about you, Linda?
So over the past weekend, I was at, one of my best friend's, bachelorette, like my first bachelorette experience ever. And part of the weekend was spent on a boat where everything just happens to taste better when you're on a boat.
Does
it? I don't know. When you're, cruising on a catamaran with the sun shining, and wind in your hair. But we had some amazing, like, grilled foods. So my friend Suzanne, her family did, like, an amazing job, like, hosting us and cooking. And so they grilled everything. And we had these, like, teriyaki grilled shrimp skewers. Ew. That were just, like, perfect.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Nice. So seasonal food has been a hot topic for a long time. Here in New York, we love seasonal produce, and many restaurants are inspired by local seasonal ingredients. At the same time, New Yorkers love eating different cultures' cuisines, yet we rarely stop to think about what seasonality means for these cuisines, because we're so used to seeing the same dishes served year-round. Today, we're going to be talking about seasonal vegetables and Chinese cuisine. That in of itself is too large a topic because China is a big country with many different cuisines. But we have the perfect guest on the show today to talk about some of the seasonal vegetables in Chinese cooking to look out for. And one vegetable in particular that's near and dear to his heart, xiangchun, also known as Chinese mahogany, Chinese tune, or red tune.
Yeah, that's right. Joining us in the studio to talk about xiangchun and other seasonal vegetables in Chinese cuisine is Jonathan Wu of the restaurant Feng Tu. A little bit about Jonathan. He decided to pursue his passion for food after he graduated from college and embarked on a period of culinary study. He attended the French Culinary Institute and has worked in France, Spain, Italy. In New York, he was executive sous chef of Geisha before taking a chef de partie position at Per Se. these days, Jonathan Wu serves American Chinese food at his restaurant Feng Tu. He combines home-cooked flavors with seasonal, regional ingredients. Welcome to the show, Jonathan.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So tell us, where did you grow up and how did that shape your passion for food?
I grew up in suburban Hartford, Connecticut. And my passion for food, I think I was born with it. I was a big fat Buddha baby. And
very lucky and auspicious.
Yes, I had big earlobes, I suppose, and a big belly. And I love to eat. My parents worked a lot. And so growing up, if I were to figure out how to make, I had to figure out how to make a snack for myself. So I suppose I got into cooking that way. And I was also fortunate to grow up with a mother who loves to cook and made really tasty home-cooked food, whether it be Chinese-inspired or American. It was quite eclectic.
Okay. What are some examples of stuff you grew up eating?
Things like beef and romaine lettuce stir-fried together, pig's foot broth with star anise and cinnamon, and hard-cooked eggs and different kinds of tofu, chili, different kinds of pasta concoctions. My mother would mix portobello mushrooms and ham and garlic and pasta. So it was quite a large spectrum of different foods.
Cool. And did you teach yourself to cook when you had to figure out how to feed yourself, or, you know, did you cook with your mom a lot?
Both. As far as the former, learning to cook, I was good at using the microwave. And when my mother would make things like dumplings, I would sit with her at the table and learn how to pleat the dumplings and figure, and she would tell me what was in the mix. So to this day, I really do kind of subscribe to her idea of an ideal dumpling filling, which is a lot of vegetables. She usually used about a half to a third meat, usually ground pork, and then mung bean sprouts, chopped spinach, lots of vegetables. And to this day, I like to put sprouts in my dumplings.
Cool. Did you think you were going to end up in food when you were younger?
No. I really had no idea what what I wanted to be or what I was going to do. I suppose I discovered it later on in life, when I was in college.
You were an English major, right?
Yeah. I guess the well-worn joke, English major, it's basically, I don't know what I want to do with my life. That was the major. And, so I chose English, something very broad and, I suppose, versatile. Mm-hmm. As I was winding down my college career, I had to make a decision, and that's when I decided to cook. I thought about what I love to do, so I love to eat, and I've always enjoyed working with my hands. I grew up playing lots of sports, so physicality and teamwork were things I enjoy. I wasn't a great student. I wasn't a bad student. Somewhere in between. But my favorite classes, when I thought about it, were usually art classes. And I thought about all those things. I suppose I was being practical.
Yeah. That seems like a logical thought process for sure.
And yeah, so then I started washing dishes after college. And that was my first kitchen job.
Oh, okay. So who are your food inspirations or food role models, both from the past and now?
My mother. It's so cliched for chef to say it, but she has, her cooking and her flavors have been the biggest single influence on my cooking. And as far as influence from professional cooking, I mean, everybody I've really worked with, I feel like that was the idea when I started cooking. Was like, oh, I'm going to try and create a path where I can work with a lot of people with the idea of learning being the number one thing. So I interned at Blue Hill when I was in culinary school, and I think it segues nicely into the topic of seasonal foods. Mm-hmm. In suburban Hartford, Connecticut, in the 80s and 90s, I was not in touch with with notions of seasonality. So in 2002, the spring of 2002, I interned at Blue Hill, and it was very eye-opening. There were things like morel mushrooms and ramps and asparagus and brook trout and nettles and soft-shell crabs, and it was wonderful. It made a huge impression on me, because to this day I try to subscribe to that as much as possible.
Nice. Can you tell us about the concept of your restaurant, Feng Tu, and what you do there?
Yes. Feng Tu means wind and soil, and then together, the dry definition is of or pertaining to a locality, something like cultural terroir. I don't really speak Chinese well, so I asked my grandfather what the characters mean together, and he defined them as hometown cooking culture. Mm. And by culture, a big part of it would be the ingredients, but it's also the, it has to do with the people and the times and the habits of the era, and the habits of the micro neighborhoods within New York. So, Feng Tu is located on lower Orchard Street on the border of Chinatown in the Lower East Side. And so I feel like the restaurant also embodies that very particular position, where in Chinatown I can go 5 blocks and get fresh rice noodles, or walk 5 blocks the other direction to Essex Market and find Latin ingredients, different dried chilies or Mexican chorizo. And they're all represented in the food. So, it is that hometown cooking culture.
That's right. Awesome. So speaking of seasonality and vegetables, we're super curious to hear your story around Xiangchun. It's not typically, or like ever used here in the States. You know, growing up from like a Northern Chinese family and having, you know, lived in Beijing, I've been fortunate to like try this dish, when my like grandmother, chops it up and stirs fry it with egg. Mm-hmm. But for our listeners, I feel like they probably don't know what it is. Jonathan, could you just maybe start by describing what it looks like, what it tastes like, where it comes from?
Yeah. Tuna sinensis is the Latin name for the tree. It's a tree. The leaves are arrow-shaped and about half the size of, say, a pinky. When they first sprout, they are like an oxblood red, and they slowly turn into more of a like a green, like an army green color. As far as the tree and the this tree was brought from China either as a sapling or seeds by a friend of my grandmother to her house in Yonkers, the suburbs of New York City. It's about 40 minutes outside the city. And at this point, the tree is probably 40 feet tall, and it's huge, and it grows kind of like a weed. There are these shoots that pop off of the roots, and those mm-hmm. are the ones that are more accessible to me on the ground. Mm-hmm. So the leaves will sprout in, I'd say, late April to May. And it's a big tree. So I think my grandmother probably planted it in the 60s or so. So my whole life it's been in their yard. But I didn't know about it, or I wasn't even interested in it until I started cooking and in my mid-20s. And so cooking for me is very important to me because, well, cooking Chinese food in particular is very important to me because it's my deepest connection to Chinese culture. And not just Chinese culture broad in a broad sense, but also like my family history. And it was kind of a gateway to these conversations with my grandparents. And I was like, oh, so my grandmother, I knew she passed. So I knew she had a really green thumb. And when I started cooking, I was like, oh, you know, what kind of edible foods do you have in the garden? And she was like, oh, well, there's this tree. And just like Linda, like she's like, oh, yeah, we've harvested it, chop it up, and then fold it into scrambled eggs. And in speaking with a lot of different Chinese Americans, like they had mentioned that, yeah, that's if they've heard of the leaf, they're like of tun leaves. That's typically the preparation with eggs. So I knew that for me, that was the point of inspiration, point of departure. It had to be tun leaves and eggs. So in creating a dish, I thought about that, and but I wanted to. The leaves are so beautiful when they're fresh. And I should describe the flavor. They're garlicky, they're minerally, and then they have this wild quality that only non-cultivated foods have, something that nettles have and ramps have. And they're somehow so Chinese in flavor, but then so unfamiliar. It was so mind blowing the first time I tasted them. I knew immediately it was a thunderbolt. It was like
how
this.
Old were you when that first time?
Yeah, I must have been. I was working as a private chef. That's when I decided. Well, that was a period when I was trying to figure out a voice.
Yeah.
In order to open a restaurant. And. That was when I decided I was going to try and cook a style of Chinese food. And that's when I asked my grandmother, you know, what kind of
treasures have you been hiding in this garden all of these years?
Yeah, there were several things outside of the tun leaves as well.
Yeah.
Things like daylilies. And around the same time, the daylily bulbs started to appear, and she's like, "Oh yeah, you can eat those too." And
it's like Willy Wonka's chocolate factory. You're just like picking leaves.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, it's like the Chinese hipster grandparents. They're like doing the Noma thing, but it's not even a thought. It's just like this is what we do.
Yeah,
accidental hipster.
Exactly.
That's so cool. And is there a period in like spring or summer where Xiangchun is harvested? I mean, I guess you can't get it in the winter. Yeah.
Yes, it is a hyper seasonal food.
Okay.
The leaves are only edible for, I'd say, 3 weeks.
Oh wow!
When they first appear. They have a glossy sheen to them, and they're still tender and have that wonderful flavor, that that garlickiness. But as time passes, the leaves become more mature, and they lose that gloss. And flavor-wise, they're more bitter. And then texturally, they're just tough. So that was just like a key moment for me. Like, oh my God, it's like this is a super seasonal ingredient. It's something that, so far as I know, I don't think anybody else is serving it fresh in New York. I've heard of it dried, but not fresh. And the other part of Feng too that's important to me was to try and express something that was soulful as well as original.
Yeah.
And so to have something like tun leaves, it's like, oh, well, this is unique and this is original. And so in that way, it's the most important ingredient, and the tun cloud, the dish that I make with it, is the most important dish to the restaurant. It's personal. It's somehow very Chinese, but also like very American too, in that that traditional egg and tuna combination, like, I wanted to highlight the beauty of the leaf. So it was about thinking about how to make an eggs be the supporting cast. Mm. So I, when I was working as a private chef, I made a dessert for my clients, and it was floating islands, a French dessert, which is whipped egg whites whipped into a meringue, mm-hmm. and then they're poached in sweetened milk, and then served with creme anglaise, like liquid ice cream.
Quite a classic old dish, right?
Yes, it's mm-hmm. a classic dish. And it was like, oh, well, there it is, a meringue. And then what I do is, well, the way I think is I took that technique out of context, out of the sweet world, and put it into the savory world. So to make the cloud for the tuna dish, I infuse egg whites with ginger, garlic, and scallion, which to me are like the essential base Chinese ingredients, with star anise, which is my favorite Chinese spice, mm-hmm. and then let the flavor infuse, take the aromatics out, and then whip the egg whites into a meringue, and then poach them in a dashi, so a stock made with seaweed, bonito flakes, and those same aromatics, ginger, garlic, and scallion, and star anise. And so it's this poached little cloud. It's served cold, chilled, mm-hmm. with the chilled broth, and then the leaves on top of it. And somehow the smoky, fishy broth really accentuates and complements the that kind of nutty, or the garlicky mineralness mm-hmm. of the leaves.
That's awesome. So when can customers get this on your menu?
They just missed the shot. I served the last one to Fuchsia Dunlop last week. It was like the last leaves that we had. Generally around, it's May. Mm-hmm. That's typically the time.
Cool. So what are some of the like upcoming seasonal ingredients you'll be using and incorporating in your menu?
I've been seeing melons, Hami melons, Western Chinese melons in the markets in Chinatown. That's been exciting. So mm-hmm. I started buying those. I've been noticing lychees been coming to market. And it's interesting, like notions of seasonality. So New York is not subtropical. So I don't think that lychees are growing in upstate or in Long Island. But there is this notion, like in Chinatown, like in December, I don't see fresh lychees, but I might see persimmons. Mm-hmm. And there are these waves of when products are available. So fall, winter, start to see persimmons, and then winter, spring, bamboo shoots, fresh bamboo shoots, which are so exciting. That's something that I recently discovered within the last 2 years. Mm-hmm. Freshly cooked bamboo compared to canned bamboo, which is tastes like tinny. It tastes like a can.
The can.
But fresh bamboo is so
cool.
Stunning. And moving into, then spring, and then the snow pea shoots arrive, and that's very exciting. And they're very expensive. I love how it's the rankings of the Chinese produce. It's like most things are $2 or less a pound, and then lo and behold, snow pea shoots, they're like $6-$10 a pound. And that's why, like, my friends are like, oh my god, like why are snow pea shoots $20 for a plate? Well, they are an expensive raw material. And they're not around all, you know, there's a window when they're available. And those are like and we're just talking about Chinatown produce now, but at Feng Tu, we also go to the Western markets too. I was there last Saturday, and strawberries were around, and mm-hmm. zucchini and garlic scapes and different carrots and the radishes and all that. And I'm really looking forward to corn and tomatoes, and that idea of cooking locally, and it's not, in my opinion, something that's just reserved to, say, French cooking or Italian mm-hmm. cooking, but that's what's represented in the States and in New York. It's a new American thing, and I think it's just such a it's just a global phenomenon, really. I mean, pre-industrial complex style shopping, everyone was cooking locally. It's something that just feels natural.
Yeah, it's kind of a reclamation of the concept even, or something like that.
Yeah.
So we're going to take a really quick break and we'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Dave Arnold, the host of Cooking Issues on the Heritage Radio Network. We all know and love Chinese takeout dishes like General Tso's chicken and egg rolls, but here's the thing. Even though we call it Chinese food, it's not like the food you'd find in China. What's the story behind this cuisine, and how did it become so popular that you can find a Chinese-American restaurant in nearly every town in the country? The answers may surprise you. Visit the Museum of Food and Drink in Brooklyn and see our newest exhibition, Chow, Making the Chinese-American Restaurant. Chow engages visitors with compelling accounts of how Chinese immigrants overcame racism and created Chinese-American cuisine. Discover the science behind the flavors of your favorite takeout dishes, feast on rotating tastings developed by the country's most talented Chinese-American chefs, and try your hand at writing your own fortune, which will be baked into actual cookies by a 1,500-pound fortune cooking machine. What better way to learn, connect, and eat? You can visit Chow at the Museum of Food and Drink on Fridays through Sundays from noon to 6. Tickets and more information can be found at mofad.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Feast Meets West, and we're here talking with Jonathan Wu about seasonality in vegetables. So, Jonathan, why do you think so many of the Chinese restaurants in New York or some of the other cities don't incorporate as much seasonality in their menus?
What a question. The best way I think I can answer that is... I think that a lot of the Chinese restaurants are operated by folks out of necessity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, dating back to the earliest times when Chinese people were immigrating to the States. I mean, after building the railroads, really only two industries were open to Chinese immigrants,
mm-hmm.
laundromats and restaurants. And so I feel like there's a long-standing tradition of opening restaurants for Chinese immigrants because that's what was open to them. And so I think that it's just simply a business
mm-hmm.
for many folks. But then as... like a second generation Chinese American, I got into it because I had the opportunity to do it.
Right.
I'm very lucky that I got to choose to do what I want to do. Whereas that wasn't the case. That's not the case for many Chinese restaurant owners. I think there is this generation of Chinese Americans who have made the choice to cook Chinese food.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's a chosen profession, there's this training. So I think that's a big difference to the original Chinese cooks in the United States making chop suey. I mean, they were not trained cooks. It was just like something that they had to learn how to do. It's like, say, people in my generation, like, we've worked around, and I think of places like Thomas Chen.
Mm-hmm.
And he's worked at 11 Madison Park, and he's trained. Say, my friends at Uncle Boone's. I mean, Anne is, she's Thai, and
mm-hmm.
she's worked at lots of great restaurants. And so there's this generation of... ethnic cooks who have cooking pedigree. and are choosing to open restaurants. And then so they start to imbue their chosen cuisines with those sensibilities.
Mm-hmm. So with seasonality, do you feel like there's a pressure to preserve some of that food to make it last as long as possible? Do you use special techniques to
I love this question so much. Yes. In terms of preserving the bounty of the season, pickling and fermenting and smoking and drying are all techniques that I love. And that I feel like are such a backbone of Chinese food. And I've recently just become more and more almost addicted to fermenting foods because I feel like they give the most powerful flavors. There's just something about, say, for example, my favorite hams are Spanish hams, like jamón ibérico. That's a fermented food, and it's nature. And it's one of those things where I don't think I could, like, cook a piece of pork chop from raw and make it taste, like, quite as good as...
Mother Nature give you a hand with that, too.
Yeah, there's just... It's such a powerful flavor. And so the smoking and drying and fermenting, we've been doing a lot of that.
Yeah. So last night, Iris and I were fortunate enough to try Jonathan's restaurant, and I noticed in your, clam paste noodle dish, there was, like, a pickled garlic chive ramp kind of ingredient, and that was really cool because it just, like, broke through, like, the saltiness of the dish.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, that there are pickled ramps, and yeah, bringing that acidity to that, yes, like, seasoned mix, giving those bright notes really helps that dish.
Allows you to eat, like, a ton more of it. how long have you had the restaurant now? Do you feel like, you know, it's evolved? Do you have other projects you're working on? What's next for you? And the restaurant, of course.
I've had Feng Tu for nearly 4 years. We opened in November of 2013. And the restaurant has evolved a lot. I feel like the voice is stronger, and there's been an evolution in terms of the food. I started off really, perhaps to a fault, wanting to try and bring a very delicate and subtle sensibility to Chinese food.
Mm-hmm.
I forget the actual word for it, but that notion of a balanced meal, the yin and yang thing, but very strongly flavored foods and also quote unquote bland. I don't think of it, it's not actually bland, but foods that taste of themselves and are not highly seasoned. Mm. I think of that as very essential cooking. I mean, it's like, say, what I think of as what Chez Panisse does, like taking a piece of produce and making it taste of itself, which was really appealing to me because that's not represented in the U.S. For most American Chinese food, it's like the ingredients are interchangeable. It's, say, a brown gravy, and the protein could be, it could be shrimp, it could be beef, it could be pork, it could be chicken. And I wanted to go to the opposite of that. I'm just like one person. So I've had to adapt. I mean, there's a certain thing that, things that are ingrained in what the dining public accepts as Chinese food. And I accept that too. You know, I I was hoping to try and contribute to the culture with the restaurant. And I feel really good about that. I feel like I've perhaps achieved that to a degree, or am trying to achieve that. You know, it's also forced me to grow up and grow as a business person. Mm-hmm. So I guess that segues into other projects. So my business partner, Wilson Tang, he owns Namwa Tea Parlor, the oldest dim sum parlor in Manhattan. And he is expanding the Namwa brand, opening satellites in Nolita and also on Canal Street in Chinatown as well. And Fung, too, has been functioning as a commissary for these other projects. Running a restaurant in New York City, it's really difficult. The margins are low and overhead's really high. So most all of us now have side hustles. It's not like, oh, we just run a restaurant. People are doing catering. They're doing delivery. They're doing events. Mm-hmm. And so acting as a commissary for the Namwa satellites is Fung Tu's side hustle. And there's probably that will continue as Namwa continues to grow.
Yeah, it's a very New York mentality. Always a side hustle.
Yes, yes.
But yeah, and I guess, you know, if people were to say your name in the industry, Jonathan Wu, what would you most like to be known for?
I would love to have a reputation of being someone who treats their staff well and has had integrity in terms of vision, you know. Mm-hmm. As much as I've had to adapt the food, I feel like I've stayed true to what Fung Tu is in that hometown cooking culture. And so those two things.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm glad you brought that up. I think it's a shame when, you know, someone in the industry like makes amazing food, but their reputation is just ruined by like, oh, wow, you know, he doesn't treat people well or doesn't have integrity. So, yeah, that's a good one. But yeah, that's all the time we have for today. So, Jonathan, for listeners who want to learn more about Fung Tu and what you do, how can they stay connected online?
Through our Instagram account, which is Fung Tu, and we're on Twitter as well, and Facebook, and our website, fungtu.com.
Yeah, cool. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you, listeners. It was an absolute pleasure to be in the studio in person this week. And while I'll be back in Hong Kong for the next episode, I already can't wait to return for my next in-person recording.
Yeah, come back. Come back, Iris. And if there are any new listeners tuning in for the first time, just a quick reminder that you can subscribe to Feast Meets West on iTunes and Stitcher, stream our episodes on feastmeetswest.com or heritageradionetwork.org, and follow what we're up to and what we're eating on our Facebook or Instagram, where our handle is at feastmeetswesteats. We'll be back next week with another awesome conversation from the world of Asian food.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.